Hello, this is Pinnacle Explains, where I discuss things scientific and practice advancing my skills and hopefully your skills doing past exam questions. This is the final year or last year of school exam in physics in the option area. This is specified option area of quantity quarks, so that's your school can take different things: medical physics, quantum quark. This is only for this year only. I think the system's going to change next year. I'll have to research that. But the aim of this is just to get down and develop your tutorial skills aligned with podcasting. That's very interesting, in actual fact, that you set up podcasting, look at the technical things, presentation skills, getting things going forward. But then again, you eventually learn to rearrange the content and the scope of what you do. In that content and scope, the actual content really for a podcast, you can really only do two questions, do justice to two questions, but it also needs a structure of reading the question, doing a general tutorial, not necessarily covering the course material. It's sometimes a bit hard to do it. General knowledge stuff, like the general knowledge stuff flow that gets you in the mood. Read the formula sheet. Make sure that people understand what's in the formula sheet, which is an important thing. Then read the question again, having briefed everything up in your mind. So you should be able to have a go at answering the question with that background. And then I'll have a go at answering the question, and then I'll go and read the examiner's version of the question. So that's how it goes, and this is what we're going to do at the moment. It's question 34 from 2015. Question A, polonium-218 is an unstable isotope that can decay to either lead-214 or to astatine, that's correct, 218 by beta decay. Oh yeah, lead by alpha decay, and astatine by beta decay. Just let me work that out in my head. So yeah, it emits an electron, classical beta. Question two, that's the lead up, and these are the actual questions. How could a Wilson cloud chamber or similar device be used to distinguish between alpha and beta decay? So how could it be used? So it's an important thing. It's you don't have to actually, just ahead there, you don't have to say how it's worked, but how could it be used? Second one, the mass of plutonium-218 nucleus is 2.00879 U, which is atomic mass. We call U a unit or atomic mass units. The mass of a lead-214 nucleus is 213.99981 U units. The mass of an alpha particle is 4.00. Okay, so that's a hard thing. Oh yeah, it's against. I'm just thinking in my head. It's against. The units is for carbon 12, so that's okay. I will allow that. Have that. That's great. It says, the question is, calculate the energy released by this alpha decay. The second question, sorry for slowing that down, as I was just I'm reading this very much for the first time. An instrument uses a beam of neutrons with a wavelength of 0.2 nanometers. Yay, just study the structure of new materials. Calculate the speed of the neutrons, which is a beautiful thing. That means it's a very slow neutron. To explain why beams of neutrons, this beam of neutron is useful to determining the structure of materials. So there's two aspects to that. So let's give a generalized talk on polonium and its decay and its history. So let's go off. Polonium, discovered by Madame Curie, named after Poland, which didn't exist at that time. Poland was a partitioned country, I think, between Russia and And Germany, I don't know whether Germany existed at that point in time. Oh yeah, probably Austria, the whole thing. And so she named it as a sort of a bit of a grab at saying if you've got the element, you should have the country. And at the time, she discovered radium, and she didn't necessarily initially identify it as a different type of a different element. She thought it was a different form of radium, so she had her initial radium. I've got to remember what where radium is on the periodic table. I think radium, it's got francium, radium. Radium's right up the top there. I'll have to remember that. Radium might be period 7. It has to be period 7. Whereas this is period 6. So period 1 is hydrogen. So if you go down, it's hydrogen, lithium, sodium, potassium. I've really forgotten what the ones are across up there. But in terms of rows of the periodic table, it's in period 6. And period 6, let's start going. I can sort of remember from around the platinum group across period 6. So I'm just saying this in general, and have a general walk into polonium so you get a general use. So the element that I really remember is, I think, I'm pretty sure it goes, and you can track it off. It's a bit unfair because it's, just seeing the periodic table in front of, in my imagination. So there's iridium, the densest element. Then there's platinum, and I just have to. Then there's gold. Now gold is the second last row in the D block, so it's an analog to fluorine-ish in the P block in terms of that row there. Then there's mercury. So mercury is in the extreme right of the D block, the sixth period, and because it's in the extreme right, it's almost equivalent to a is equivalent to a noble gas. So that's the reason why it's liquid. These are all heavier. And then after that, you start to get into the P block, that big square. Well, basically it's 6 by 6 because the helium you really is right should be across in the S block. This is a quantum mechanical version of the periodic table. I know what I'm talking about. Next element there is under the boron strip, which would be the third period in the third group 3, or you could also call it group 13, depending how you go. There's Roman numerals. Other numerals, group 13, if you include the transition elements. If you don't include the transition elements, you'd say it's a group 3, and we tend to say group 3 in terms of the course, sort of a group 3 dope carbon, which is group 4 with a group 3, and Dec pave, it's a group 3 will lead a positive acceptor valence band from group 3, boron. But go right down, you get on that same, you go boron, aluminium, all the way down to thallium. Now thallium, being close to the lead, is an ex and binding binding up is an excellent poison. We know this because the king, the area where they sold heaps and heaps of thallium, is in the Depression, Sydney. Because Sydney had a rat plague in the Great Depression after World War I. Rat plagues, there was actually a plague. There was outbreaks of the plague in Sydney, apparently, or so I'm told. And I sort of know about thallium because knocking around in the country sheds, real old shearing sheds which have been left and stuff like that. Of course, there'd be, I think it was chicken sheds. I went to, you see this old bottle, and it'll have the word thallium on it from the Great Depression. These are gained from these people who lived through the Great Depression, were all hoarders that have milk bottles full of nails and things, rust and old parts and stuff like that. I'll shed. So thallium was a fairly famous poison. Famous because there was someone who used to invite people into their house, or husbands into the house. I can't really remember it. And she used to bake them thallium pies, and they'd eventually die, and eventually some detectives worked it out. And the twist at the end is that you follow the careers of the detectives, and they turned out themselves to be corrupt. It was a sort of beautiful window. So thallium is a poison, no longer used because it's such an effective poison. I think there's other things. Warfarin came in, for sure, my favourite rat poison, which is keeping me alive. But there was reasons that you didn't want to give large quantities of rat, thallium chemical out there. I don't know whether how good it was for the environment. Apart from that, I don't know what its use is. I don't know. I'm sure it's used in some electronics somewhere for some doping or something. So after thallium, you have lead. So lead is thallium's in group 3, lead's in group 4 under carbon, and you ask what's going on. Still has the band gap, but the indirect band gap has meant that you've got overlapping bands. And how can you have overlapping bands? Well, you have to look in three dimensions. So lead, the stable 208, is the base stable lead, and so everything above lead decays. If it doesn't undergo fission, it goes to lead, and so lead goes there. Now, just a small fun fact about lead is that zirconium crystals, and there's heaps and heaps of zirconium crystals. In fact, you get any piece of rock, and I can't believe I'm saying this because I can't believe zircons in such concentration, but apparently any piece of rock you can grade up, and then you can. This is just going off complete recall. So remember that I've been off harder operations, and this is recall. I hope I'm recalling this from the correct part of my brain. Okay, so I'm not thinking this ahead. It's just coming to me. So any piece of rock, they grind it up, and you can actually pull out zirconium crystals because they're magnetic. I know they use a magnet to sort them, or they may not be magnetic, maybe magnetic. Take zircon crystals, and then they spectrum analyze them, because zircon, when it forms, hates lead. It's one thing, it just doesn't like lead. It does love uranium, and the uranium it's got in it turns into lead eventually. So zirconium is your basic wristwatch on any rock. You pick up any rock, and you can get the crystals to see lead, because the only way lead can actually get into zirconium is being uranium and then go through decay to get into it. So there's a lot of lead. There's lead tastes sweet. Lead's in paint of various toys. A lot of toys that used to come from China, beautifully painted, very cheap, but full of lead paint, even though they signed all the forms. So it wasn't through lead that people would bring their kid, do the blood test, and then go around the place. And we've got there's a lead city or silver city, which is Broken Hill, which has got a large amount of lead just due to the mining. Of course, lead was used as an anti-knock agent in fuels, and has accounted probably knocked off one IQ point and caused huge amounts of disease and death in our country. Of course, no one gets the blame. It was part of industry. People are making money out of it, so it's rather hard. But we've got rid of lead petrol. After lead becomes bismuth. So the relative atomic mass doesn't go up. So lead probably 80. Oh, I can't remember that 82 number of protons in lead. Off the head, I can't remember. Bismuth is one extra proton. Bismuth is my. I'm absolutely in love with bismuth, because it can melt. Obviously, all metals can melt, but it's melt. It's non-toxic. Lead's toxic. Bismuth is. Thallium is very toxic. Lead's quite toxic. It sort of sends you a bit dumb over time and crazy, like a nutcase. I'm pretty sure that there's some people I know who I would expect have had plenty of lead sandwiches. However, bismuth is different. You can eat it. You can sprinkle it on your lunch quite well. Unfortunately, you can sprinkle it in your shotguns to shoot down ducks. So to get across, the environmentalists, they've said, you're concerned about lead. All the environment is saying, look, you can shoot them, except we can't tolerate the amount of lead that you shoot in the various ducts. And so they've changed their shots to bismuth shots. Don't know how bismuth goes in terms of density and stuff like that. And the real killer with the bismuth is that you can just melt it up on the stove. It goes liquid on the stove, and then you can pour it out, and it crystallizes, beautiful crystals, and oxidizes. So there's these beautiful, bit like Aztec pyramids, which form, these crystals form, and these get these beautiful blues on top of it, where you get oxide layers on it, and a bit like nobelium. There's tantalum, nobelium. There's one excellent oxide metal further out. That's a different story. Bismuth, lead's super stable. Bismuth, they thought was stable, but it turns out to be just ever so slightly unstable, ever so slightly unreactive, and it will decay in a fraction of the time of the solar system or something like that, some incredibly long time. So bismuth is not effectively not radioactive. That's sort of like similar radioactivity to uranium. Uranium is radioactive. Yes. Uranium-235 is quite radioactive. Uranium-238, which is the depleted uranium, or the non-ore grade uranium, is not very radioactive at all. Quite pleasant to have around. So we've got bismuth, amazing. And after bismuth is polonium, which is here discovered by Madame Curie from Pitchblende. She was getting out radium, and she initially named the various plutoniums poloniums as, not plutoniums, poloniums as, they're unstable, all of them are unstable, but she named them radiums, and then said, no, look, they're a separate element, and sort of rubbed her notebook out and put poloniums. Now, what I can say, there's a lot of people are a bit sanctimonious. I've read some of Curie's work, or Curie's autobiography, and the belief she was really a crystal, a New Age crystal person back then, and believed that radiation was not from the nucleus, but channeled from an energy field in the universe coming out, which is probably a reasonable thing to say. If you gave someone something radioactive down, it was glowing in the corner, you'd think a ghost. So there's lots of that interesting stuff, and she had a really interesting relationship with her daughter, who was basically discovered the neutron. But Mum said, oh, you're mad, there's no such thing as neutrons. I'm not saying that too well. So that's polonium, and then polonium is under the oxygen. So lead's under carbon, bismuth is under nitrogen, polonium's under oxygen, astatine, so chlorine, it's all in that group here, which is group 7. Is astatine sort of a fairly, it doesn't last very long as far as I know. There's no so after lead, everything after lead, and definitely after bismuth, everything is unstable, except uranium has a uranium-238 has a really long half-life due to stability in the number of neutrons and protons in it. So it's sort of a bit of a freak. So there's astatine, and then you've got the noble gases, radon. So radon is the gas which pours out. Then you go around here. I'm pretty sure it's radium, magnesium. Yeah, radium will be under the magnesium strip, beryllium, all the way down to magnesium. And we should actually have a little chat about polonium. Polonium is one monster of a radioactive alpha particle source. And what used to happen is they'd make in the center of these beautiful US, early US bombs that have something called the urchin, which is polonium on the inside, and polonium, which is urchin, which they'd electroplate polonium. Then it electroplate gold or something like that as an alpha particle emitter, so keep polonium under wraps, and then they'd put in electroplate beryllium and create this fantastic thing that it was a source of neutrons. So you could crush this urchin in an explosion, and it would suddenly shower out neutrons, which would make the bomb go off. So the bomb probably go off anyway, but this made it 100% sure. When you exploded it, there were so many neutrons going along that all bets were off. You didn't have to do too many calculations. You had the sea urchin there. So that's group 6. So let's go through group 6 again. There's iridium, platinum, gold, mercury, that's the end of your D block, thallium, lead. I'm having a brain fade here. There's lead, bismuth, polonium, astatine, and radon. And radon's the gas which comes out. So that's not really a physics lesson. That's just a general thing. Now we'll talk about the cloud chamber. So when you have something super cooled, it wants to change shape or change state very quickly. So super chilled water, just give it a tap or drop in a piece of flake of dandruff. I don't know how we know that, but flake, skin flake or anything in it will suddenly shatter. So in Antarctica, I know people who throw their water, let the water chill down after boiling, let it chill down, and they throw it, and it turns to ice in midair. And yeah, so a lot of the icing that you get on parachutes or planes and hailstones is the super cool water turning to solid. So the entire thing is that you get a super cooled gas. I don't know, it could be water, steam. I know with the Wilson's or the clouds chambers that we have, I don't know where they're technical. Wilson's cloud chamber, they make it go super critical, ready to condense. It's a contrail around any charged particle by changing the pressure. And that's something that you can switch on, switch off. Once you've got the particle trace, you say, got it, photographed it, you want to switch it off, Wilson's cloud chamber. The ones that you generally have are these ones which are cooled by liquid nitrogen, and you have a wires on the top to create a field, because what you want to do is once it's created a contrail, you want that contrail of the charged particle. So what happens, the ionized particle goes through and it deposits its energy, just ionizing everything as it goes along. Typically there's a couple of millivolts, million electron volts, so it can ionize a fair amount of stuff. And you have wires on top of it just to tell you what its structure. A lot of people just don't know the structure of these things. You've got DC voltage, so this is one of the things, if you've got kiddies touching it, you have to be careful when the way you construct it. And you have a system of the isopropanol, I think, just climbs up the walls. I think it climbs up the walls, evaporates, and forms a convection current. So you use isopropanol, one of my favorite solvents. Absolutely slightly oily alcohol, just super good for cleaning, doesn't leave residue. It's a rubbing alcohol. So you pour that in, and it circulates around. And on an air current, the other thing is that the cold source in the center and heat on the outside gives you that lovely circulating current. And so as it goes down, so it's going down, and it super cools. It goes obviously from hotter, warm stuff where it's a nice vapor, and it wants to form a mist. And so you've got to get a source of coolness. Now, what you can do, which seems like a lot of hard work, but seems the obvious thing to do, you can get Peltier crystals, which is the Peltier effect, is the thermocouple effect. I've forgotten it's just escaped my memory. And this is what I'm trying to do at the moment, just get my memory going. When you put two dissimilar metals together, I've got to remember the name of that effect. I've got different names going to my head, I'm not going to remember it. But you use a Peltier effect, which is the opposite way. You drive a current through different metals at junctions, hot and cold junctions, and you cool the hot junction, which cools the cool junction even more. So the higher energy electrons go to the hot junction. You make it fairly small. You cool that, which is just with a fan, because it heats up above room temperature, and the cold junction goes beneath room temperature by a long shot. It starts pulling. The hot junction gets heated by the room air. Sort of the opposite thing going along. So you have a layer of these several junctions to make a Peltier, and so you can just plug in a little tabletop effect. And obviously, this is. I don't understand why they don't do this now. They thinking these ones are cloud chambers, and these are quite good. You basically need a microscope, a microscope or a CCD camera to illuminate these things, and you want side lighting for it. And the electric field, which is from the top going downwards, actually drags the actual contrail downwards, so you actually get a band of colour, a band of cloud going in. So without the electric field, nothing really, you can't see anything, but when you turn on that electric field, a couple hundred volts that you need in these things to turn them on. These are just some of the things. Go on YouTube, and it's really essential for the students to see this. Let them study it first, right, and work it out, do a few problems of it, and when they see it, their jaws just drop. You see a little radiation source, and the little sparks, little radiation rays travel out. Now, without a magnetic field, they don't turn. Now, what happens is, I can't see why we can't have a super magnet underneath this and get them turning, but I don't think you need a fairly strong magnetic field. What happens is that the magnetic field points towards you out of the page, and using the right-hand slap rule, the current, depending on the charge, will move left or right, so that you can pick out the current and pick out the mass from these things. So I think I may have discussed this. Oh, no, now we have to go on. This is going to be a long thing. Cloud chamber, and so... going back to units, that's of cloud chambers and detection. We want to talk about mass defects. So the entire thing of getting energy out of these little things your mass defect. So what you, I'm going to have to be quite honest with you. One of the nucleus contains all the, your radio nucleus contains all the energy that's going to come out of this reaction when it decays. So before it's the nucleus, afterwards you've got to decay. Now, yes, you've got products, physical products which you can count. You've also got radiation, gamma rays, which you have to account for, and kinetic energy. So these travel off with a kinetic energy. So an alpha particle or an electron get pushed out of the nucleus, and there's kinetic energy associated with it. So there's a lot to detail, but in general we just say we get everything, and then we let the radiation disappear, and we slow down everything. The electron goes to rest. The electrons aren't moving, and the alpha particles aren't moving. There's no kinetic energy. We just look at the mass, and that we call that the mass defect. So there's a bit of a sleight of hand there. So we say that the mass changes, which is due to a different amount of particles traveling in the strong nuclear force. So your protons and neutrons are no longer bound in the strong nuclear force in the Saxon Woods potential. Let's get going. And so there's Dalton, who had the atomic theory, first idea that things are little spheres, and the proposal was that hydrogen was a basic unit, and they also had a few things hard to work out because they didn't know about neutrons and protons coming forward or definitely about isotopes. And so initially hydrogen was it, and then The number of units have been rather useful or interesting. Because when I went through, it was an AMU. Now they've converted it to U. It's still called atomic mass unit. Let's just slow down here and actually get through three terms about atomic mass units. So the DA is a Dalton, and U is called the unit or atomic mass unit. They're small u, capital DA, and the Dalton is spelt small letter DALTON, because a Dalton is actually a scientist or a bloke called Dalton. Dalton as a unit is written like Newton, it's a small letter Newton, but the big N for the Newton, similar for Dalton, DA. Sort of, I don't know very many people that use DA. You could use U, it's atomic mass unit. Atomic mass unit is the actual physical mass. It corresponds, used to be a ratio, but now I think it goes into a U is in, it can actually be converted to grams. It can be converted into kilograms or usefully MeV, because they do the divided by C squared for you, MeV. And so 1 AU is, one U is 935, look, I could be wrong, 0.15, it's at the head, I can see the number in my head, but I can't actually read it, I haven't brought that formula sheet out, MeV, yeah, I just have to remember, oh yeah, an electron is 1.4 MeV to produce one, or annihilation energy, but getting for that, so you just get the difference in U. So U is the U unit of the unit. Now let's go through. AMU is in kilograms for a particular bloody nucleus. You've got a nucleus in front of you. It's got an AMU, but the number that you see in the periodic table is not the AMU, that's the relative atomic mass found on Earth by predominantly American scientists. So if you pick up another rock, you know, if the Mars made a periodic table, it would have different numbers underneath it, just subtly different. In fact, if we get a rock from Mars, we pick it up, put it in a mass spectrometer and go, oh my god, that's come from Mars, because I know, again, scientists who go down to Antarctica, and it's sort of like meteor finding found easy. It's nice and I'm going to get to this answer eventually. Where are we? Oh, we've got another thing to go. So look, I'm glad I've got a lot to talk about here. So you've got the AMU, the relative atomic mass, and the atomic mass number. So the atomic mass number is, we go 1, 2, 1, proton 2, proton 3, 4, 3, and you count the number of protons and nucleuses up. And when you sum it all up, the number of protons which you put on one corner is Z, and the number of protons and neutrons is sort of like there's atomic mass number, atomic mass unit, which is a kilogram, and which deals with the actual isotope in front of you, whereas a ram is a weighted mass from where you are. So fluorine's 35.5, split in half. There's roughly, and it's more complicated than this, 50, 35 atomic AMUs and 50... 36 AMU, and it goes through there. So it's a bit complicated to work through here. So the next, sort of talking about neutrons. Now, quantum physics, it's sort of like a no-brainer. If something's got less kinetic energy, it grows in size. And you say, how can that be? Well, your neutron, as you slow down a neutron, it gets bigger. In fact, if you were to slow down a neutrino from the sun, and I suppose you can, because neutrinos could go through collisions and stuff like that. So a neutrino gets made in the core of the sun and travels through 500,000 kilometres of sun to reach you. effortlessly. But say if you slow that down, that would be the size of a basketball hitting you. How does it hit you? How come I don't see it? Well, because it's a lepton with no charge. It's got no it doesn't interact with your eyes or your body or anything like that. Similar to a neutron. So slow down a neutron, it gets bigger. And you say, oh, how can it get? Well, the neutron they're talking here has got is the size of, you know, a couple of let's see, a nanometer. I think there's 10 atoms or more in a nanometer, or it's a few hundred. This is a few atoms wide. A neutron is a few atoms wide. Scratch your head about that one. And electrons also get expanded as you slow down. In fact, if you supercool helium, it goes into a Bose-Einstein contact state, and you can actually see a helium atom underneath the microscope, or a single group of helium atoms on top of each other. So one is be so thin you couldn't see it, but you put on enough, you can see it under a microscope. That's how you slow down. How do we make a beam of? I'll just go through a beam of neutrons, because this Australia has a small Argentinian nuclear reactor. And when I say small, quite small, it's something the size of a fridge, the actual nuclear reactor section. And in aluminium plates, the non-reactor grade uranium is actually concentrated beneath what you need for a nuclear reactor. It's enough for a research reactor, and it produces heaps of neutrons, and the neutrons aren't lost. They're all mothered. They're all put in heavy water, and they don't hit it, and they're slowed down through collisions with the heavy water, and then they're guided down these tubes. I think there's about 8 neutron tubes in a hall for neutron beams. That's how they get the neutrons. And so a neutron doesn't have any charge. It does have a magnetic moment, which is an important thing. So how does it have a magnetic moment? Well, it's got spin. That's one thing. It interacts with other, it bounces off other slow neutrons. But it can actually just travel through matter. How does it have a magnetic moment? Well, you know, look, how does a fridge magnet work? There's no current. The fridge magnets, there's no current in there. There's no metal in a fridge magnet. It's all due to there's actually no current. There's no electromagnet in a fridge magnet. So it's all quantum mechanical. So magnetism is, there's remnant magnetism, if you'd like to say, trapped inside a neutron. In the actual formation of the neutron, it's, oh, I don't know, quantum string theory, it's an S2 symmetry particle. It's like one of these fundamental particles, S2 symmetry. So it's got spin up, spin down, or 720 degrees inversion symmetry. Well, that's enough of that for the moment. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to read through the relative formulas. Okay, there's not the relative. Oh, yes, there is a relevant formula here for you all. Okay, firstly, what I want to say is I'll just read through all the relevant formulas here. There's a relevant formula I don't have here, which is the conversion of U to MeV. It's sort of like the, well, that's a walk in the park one. Let's read through this. F equals QVB sine theta. So the force on a particle equals Q times its velocity times the magnetic field in Tesla times sine theta, the angle with respect to that magnetic field. So if it's travelling along the magnetic field line, it ain't no, but if it's travelling 90 degrees to its all full force. E equals V on D. Again, not in the Wilson's car chamber, that this the electric field is the voltage over the distance. Doesn't really do. Now, this is interesting. This is really irritates me here, because they've got E equals V on D. Then they've got the next formula, E equals HF, Planck's constant times the frequency. Now, again, that's the energy in joules, if you have the Planck's constant in joule seconds, the frequency in seconds. C, the speed of light, equals the frequency times the wavelength. but it's only for a photon or something travelling at the speed of light. Then they've got the Rydberg equation, which is 1 lambda equals r into 1 on n final squared minus 1 on n I squared. 1 on lambda is what you get straight from a spectroscope, but 1 lambda actually corresponds by pushing it through the previous equation that corresponds to energy, and you convert your energy to EV, and you can replace the Rydberg constant with the first ionization level of first energy level of hydrogen, put it in there. Then we have wavelength equals Planck's constant on MV, but they have the V there, a cursive V. I don't know whether that's absolutely correct, because the V looks a bit like a mu for frequency, sort of angular frequency. Mu is angular frequency, 2 pi f is mu, the frequency. But this is MV. So the mass on the proton divided by V gives it to you. And so that's something that you have to know. It comes from quantum mechanics, but very much this de Broglie proposed that formula. It's interesting to know that H is a unit of angular momentum, which is standard momentum times a distance. And so H, that's a way of getting the wavelength of a particle. Very important things to go through. Now, what I'm going to do is read the question and then answer the question. Okay. Plutonium-218 is an unstable isotope and can decay to lead-214 by alpha particle decay. I should have told you what alpha particles are. They're helium nuclei. If you're listening to this, look, I'm going to improve. Okay. Acetine or acetine-218 by beta decay. I think that was the first grade of plutonium found. So I have to stop at this point and tell you an alpha particle is a helium nucleus, H42. Interesting that they swap units around. So in general, you put the A number up the top and as a pre superscript and as a pre subscript that's coming before the Z number. Okay. Question: how could a Wilson's cloud chamber or similar device be used to distinguish between alpha and beta decay? The chamber could be used by observing the track produced by the ionized particle. The particle emerging from a radioactive nuclei will ionize the surrounding air by collisions and I suppose the acceleration of the charges as it collides past it. And this will form a nucleation point for the supercooled vapor under pressure conditions to actually form a small cloud track by looking, photographing and measuring the radius of curvature of the cloud track and applying, knowing that their force is MQ VB, we can work out, that's force equals QVB, and that the radius is given by MV squared on R. By measuring the radius, we can, and knowing the B, we can deduce the magnetic field, velocity and mass of the relative mass of the object. So we can actually determine, we can determine whether it's an alpha particle or beta particle by the actual thickness of the cloud. So alpha particles have thicker clouds than thinner clouds. I wonder if we're going to get this one. And we can look at radius produced, and whether it turns clockwise or anti-clockwise in the field will give you the sign of the charge from it. And so that's how we can determine. So alpha particle will have, will turn one way in the field, beta particle will turn the other way of the field, the cloud thickness will be different for the two, and your mass velocity ratio depending on what the energy is. So you could actually get the same radius of curvature if you had had different things, and the loss and curve through it. Now let's read what they have here. This is a long one. Oh well. In Wilson's cloud chamber, the paths of alpha particles and betas can be seen. Alpha particles produce shorter and thicker trails. Okay. Well, along that, I was going to say there's a magnetic field in there, but they just haven't even answered that one. Next question is, the mass of plutonium 218 is some number of U, AMU. The mass of the lead of 214 is so much AMU. So I gave you far too much information before in that lecture about acetone. The mass of an alpha particle is 4.0260 AMU. U, atomic mass units. I shouldn't say AMU, it's U and atomic mass units. So what you'd do is you'd subtract the lead and the helium from the plutonium and say, well, they're not moving anywhere. There's no other recoil energy or anything to do with that. And then just bung it in. Whatever you got, you'd multiply it by 935 MeV and see that's the energy released. Credit quote. Let's see what they mean. They've done that. They said applies methods to calculate the mass defect. So we've got the mass defect in either MeV or joules, and the E is 931.5. I've got that wrong. I said 0.15. Don't worry. Oh yeah. Okay. I can see how I visualized that incorrectly. Just remember the 1.5 and put 93.15 MeV times 0.006256 or 6.1 MeV. So that's quite a powerful little alpha particle source. That would have been the alpha particle would be screaming out there because it's a elastic collision. The lighter particle takes away more of the kinetic energy. Okay. B. An instrument uses a beam of neutrons of wavelength 0.2 nanometers to study the structure of new materials. The materials calculate the speed of the neutrons. The wavelength is written down there. H should read from the periodic table. It's using lambda equals H on MV. We've got the mass of the neutron, and we just put that in. So we put in the formula and get the marks. I don't see how you get two marks. Probably one mark for the formula, getting the formula, lambda equals H on MV. Another mark for the actual substitution. Explain why a beam of neutrons is useful in determining the structure of materials. This beam of neutrons. This beam of neutrons has a wavelength of 0.2 nanometers. So that's the roughly the interatomic spacing. So it would be able to see effects if you crystals. It will diffract. So you'd be able to move it this way. You'd be able to use diffraction for it. It's large size. So be diffractions, but it wouldn't interact with the actual positions. It would interact with the spin magnetic moments, so it would be useful because of its wavelength and looking at the structure of the particle, and also because of the magnetic structure of it. I think it's really useful giving a talk first because I don't have to overload you with the information. I can give you the direct answer, and their answer, drum roll, is So I forgot to tell you, they put in the numbers and got 2,000 metres per second, which is pretty amazingly fast speed anyway. This is for 34B part 1, 34B part 2, explaining why neutron beams determine the structure of materials. The beam of neutrons can be used in scattering experiments. What? Extremely small wavelengths makes neutron beams studying matter at atomic level, which allows smaller objects to be distinguished than, say, visible light. The fact that neutrons have no electric charge prevents them from being affected by the presence of protons and electrons, allowing them greater penetration into material. Well, these guys haven't visited ANSTO. So the actual neutrons actually scatter. Not scatter. You wouldn't call it a diffraction experiment, scattering. Scattering is you put in one neutron and you see where it goes. A diffraction experiment is that you have a beam of neutrons and they actually reinforce and coherently decompose, move. And the important thing is, yes, we all know that they don't, well, I suppose you have to say they don't have a charge, but they have the magnetic moment. You've got to interact with matter somehow, and they interact with the magnetic moments of the neutrons and nuclei inside, and even electrons there, the local magnetic fields to probe it going forward. So there again, you just have to, they're obviously expect an answer equivalent to the knowledge understood by students. My only comment is that they're much smaller objects distinguished by it's like compared it to visible light. I suppose that's a reasonable thing. So I hope this has been a useful format. It appears to be a clearer format here where I go through, give the lecture first, give a background knowledge. It means that I can do the formula fairly quickly, then reread the answer and then give a fairly precise question, and people sort of know my knowledge base first, sort of know where the answer is coming from, and they don't get absolutely shocked as they're thinking they know the answer, then I introduce new things, and I think, oh, how can that possibly be? It's just the general studying to go through to it. Obviously, an incredibly worthwhile field. I mean, the average person does not know neutrons. In fact, I've spoken to teachers who've been teaching for 30 years, and they didn't know that neutrons go through ordinary matter. They had no idea. They thought they went through ordinary matter because they were really small, and they could actually get through the gaps and stuff like that. And these are people who had actually been to ANSTO. ANSTO is our nuclear reactor. And they'd been so caught up with not doing any quantum physics at all that even when things were very obvious in front of them, they didn't understand it. So that's an interesting aspect in terms of education of teachers. Thanks for listening. Keep on thinking physics, doing some physics, whether it be calculations or basic tests or something like that. And when you've done those two things, teach physics. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening.